then another. Thanks to the trailer, they didn't see the woman who was now half in and half out of the deformed station wagon, like Br'er Rabbit stuck in the tar baby. Nor did they hear her screams. One driver was listening to Toby Keith, the other to Led Zeppelin. Both had his particular brand of music turned up loud. In the restaurant, Pete Simmons heard her, but only from a great distance, like a fading echo. His eyelids fluttered, then the screams stopped. Pete rolled over on the filthy mattress and went back to sleep. The thing that looked like a car ate Julianne Vernon, clothes, boots, and all. The only thing it missed was her phone, which now lay beside Doug Clayton's. Then it popped back into its station wagon shape with the same racket-hitting ball sound. In the Haas trailer, Dee Dee nickered and stamped an impatient foot. She was hungry. 4. The Lucier Family, 11 Expedition. 6-year-old Rachel Lucier shouted, "Look, Mommy, look, Daddy. It's the horse lady. See her trailer? See it?" Carla wasn't surprised Rach was the first to spot the trailer, even though she was sitting in the back seat. Rach had the sharpest eyes in the family. No one else even came close. X-ray vision, her father sometimes said. It was one of those jokes that isn't quite a joke. Johnny, Carla, and 4-year-old Blake all wore glasses. Everyone on both sides of the family wore glasses. Even Bingo, the family dog, probably needed them. Bing was apt to run into the screen door when he wanted to go out. Only Rach had escaped the curse of myopia. The last time she'd been to the optometrist, she'd read the whole damn eye chart bottom line, and Dr. Stratton had been amazed. "She could qualify for jet fighter training," he told Johnny and Carla. Johnny said, "Maybe someday she will. She's certainly got a killer instinct when it comes to her little brother." Carla had thrown him an elbow for that, but it was true. She had heard there was less sibling rivalry when the Sibs were of different sexes. If so, Rachel and Blake were the exception that proved the rule. Carla sometimes thought the most common two words she heard these days were, "started it." Only the gender of the pronoun opening the sentence varied. The two of them had been pretty good for the first 100 miles of this trip, partially because visiting with Johnny's parents always put them in a good mood, and mostly because Carla had been careful to fill up the no man's land between Rachel's booster seat and Blake's car seat with toys and coloring books. But after their snack and pee stop in Augusta, the squabbling had begun again. Probably because of the ice cream cones. Giving kids sugar on a long car trip was like squirting gasoline on a campfire. Carla knew this, but you couldn't refuse them everything. In desperation, Carla had started a game of Plastic Fantastic, serving as judge and awarding points for lawn gnomes, wishing wells, statues of the Blessed Virgin, etc. The problem was the turnpike, where there were lots of trees but very few vulgar roadside displays. Her sharp-eyed 6-year-old daughter and her sharp-tongued 4-year-old boy were beginning to renew old grudges when Rachel saw the horse trailer pulled over just a little shy of the old Mile 81 rest stop. "Want to pet the horsey again?" Blake shouted. He began thrashing in his car seat, the world's smallest breakdancer. His legs were just long enough to kick the back of the driver's seat, which Johnny found Trey annoying. "Somebody tell me why I wanted to have kids," he thought. "Somebody remind me just what I was thinking. I know it made sense at the time." "Blakey, don't kick Daddy's seat," Johnny said. "Want to pet the horsey," Blake yelled, and fetched the back of the driver's seat an especially good one. "You are such a babykins," Rachel said, safe from brother kicks on her side of the backseat DMZ. She spoke in her most indignant big girl tone, the one always guaranteed to infuriate Blakey. "I am ain't a babykins." "Blakey," Johnny began, "if you don't stop kicking Daddy's seat, Daddy will have to take his trusty butcher knife and amputate Blakey's little feetsies at the ankle." "She's broken down," Carla said. "See the traffic cones? Pull over." "Hun, that'd be the breakdown lane. Not such a good idea." "No, just swing around and park beside those other two cars, on the ramp. There's room and you won't be blocking anything because the rest area is closed. If it's okay with you, I'd like to get back to Falmouth before pull over." Carla heard herself using the DEFCON 1 tone that brooked no refusal, even though she knew it was a bad idea. How many times lately had she heard Rach using that exact same tone on Blake, using it until the little guy broke down in tears? Switching off the she-who-must-be-obeyed voice and speaking more softly, Carla said, "That woman was nice to the kids." They had pulled into Damon's next to the horse trailer when they stopped for ice cream. The horse lady, nearly as big as a horse herself, was leaning against the trailer, eating an ice cream cone of her own and feeding something to a very handsome beastie. To Carla, the treat looked like a Kashi granola bar. Johnny had one kid by each hand and tried to walk them past, but Blake was having none of that. "Can I pet your horse?" he asked. "Cost you a quarter," the big lady in the brown riding skirt had said, and then grinned at Blakey's crestfallen expression. "Nah, I'm only kidding. Here, hold this." She thrust her drippy ice cream cone at Blake, who was too surprised to do anything but take it. Then she lifted him up to where he could pet the horse's nose. Dee Dee regarded the wide-eyed child calmly, sniffed at the horse lady's dripping cone, decided it wasn't what she wanted, and allowed her nose to be stroked.
"Whoa, soft," Blake said.
Carla had never heard him speak with such simple awe. Why haven't we ever taken these kids to a petting zoo, she wondered, and immediately put it down on her mental to-do list.
"Me, me, me,"
Rachel bugled, dancing around impatiently. The big lady set Blake down. "Lick that ice cream while I lift your sister," she told him. "But don't get cooties on it, okay?" Carla thought of telling Blake that eating after people, especially strange people, was not okay. Then she saw Johnny's bemused grin and thought, what the hell? You sent your kids to schools that were basically germ factories. You drove them for hundreds of miles on the turnpike where any drunk maniac or texting teenager could cross the median strip and wipe them out. Then you forbade them to lick on a partially used ice cream? That was taking the car seat and bike helmet mentality a little too far, maybe. The horse lady lifted Rachel so Rachel could pet the horse's nose.
"Wowie, nice,"
Rachel said.
"What's her name?"
"Dee Dee."
"Great name. I love you, Dee Dee."
"I love you too, Dee Dee," the horse lady said, and put a big old smackaroo on Dee Dee's nose. That made them all laugh.
"Mom, can I have a horse?"
"Yes,"
Carla said warmly.
"When you're 26.
This made Rachel put on her mad face, puckered brow, puffed cheeks, lips down to a stitch, but when the horse lady laughed, Rach gave up and laughed too. The big woman bent down to Blakey, her hands on knees, covered by her riding skirt.
"Can I have my ice cream cone back, young fella?"
Blake held it out. When she took it, he began to lick his fingers, which were covered with melting pistachio.
"Thank you,"
Carla told the horse lady. "That was very kind of you." Then to Blake,
"Let's get you inside and cleaned up. After that, you can have ice cream."
"I want what she's having,"
Blake said. And that made the horse lady laugh some more. Johnny insisted that they eat their cones in a booth because he didn't want them decorating the expedition with pistachio ice cream. When they finished and went out, the horse lady was gone. Just one of those people you meet. Occasionally nasty, more often nice, sometimes even terrific, along the road, and never see again. Only here she was. Or at least, here her truck was, parked in the breakdown lane with traffic cones neatly placed behind her trailer. And Carla was right, the horse lady had been nice to the kids. So thinking, Johnny Lucier made the worst and last decision of his life. He flipped his blinker and pulled onto the ramp as Carla had suggested, parking ahead of Doug Clayton's Prius, which was still flashing its four ways, and beside the muddy station wagon. He put the transmission in park, but left the engine running.
"I want to pet the horsey," Blake said.
"I also want to pet the horsey," Rachel said in the haughty lady of the manor tone of voice she had picked up God knew where. It drove Carla crazy, but she refused to say anything. If she did, Rach would use it all the more.
"Not without the lady's permission," Johnny said. "You kids sit right where you are for now. You too, Carla."
"Yes, master," Carla said in the zombie voice that always made the kids laugh.
"Very funny, Easter Bunny."
"The cap of the truck's empty," Carla said. "They all look empty. Do you think there was an accident?"
"Don't know, but nothing looks dinged up. Hang on a minute."
Johnny Lucier got out, went around the back of the expedition he would never finish paying for,
and walked to the cab of the Dodge Ram. Carla hadn't seen the horse lady, but he wanted to make sure she wasn't lying on the seat, maybe trying to live through a heart attack. A lifelong jogger, Johnny secretly believed a heart attack was waiting by age 45 at the latest for anyone who weighed even 5 pounds over the target weight prescribed by medicine.net. She wasn't sprawled on the seat. Of course not, a woman that big Carla would have seen even lying down. And she wasn't in the trailer either. Only the horse, who poked her head out and sniffed Johnny's face. Hello there. For a moment, the name didn't come. Then it did. Dee Dee. How's the old feed bag hanging? He patted her nose, then headed back up the ramp to investigate the other two vehicles. He saw there had been an accident of sorts, albeit a very tiny one. The station wagon had knocked over a few of the orange barrels blocking the ramp. Carla rolled down her window, a thing neither of the kids in the back could do because of the lockout feature.
Any sign of her?
Nope.
Any sign of anyone? Carl, give me a chit.
He saw the cell phones and the wedding ring lying beside the partially open door of the station wagon.
What?
Carla craned to see.
Just a sec.
The thought of telling her to lock the doors crossed his mind, but he dismissed it. They were on I-95 in broad daylight, for God's sake. Cars passing every 20 or 30 seconds, sometimes two or three in a line. He bent down and picked up the phones, one in each hand. He turned to Carla, and thus did not see the car door opening wider, like a mouth.
Carla, I think there's blood on this one.
He held up Doug Clayton's cracked phone.
Mom?
Rachel asked.
Who's in that dirty car? The door's opening.
Come back, Carla said. Her mouth was suddenly dust dry. She wanted to yell it, but there seemed to be a stone on her chest. It was invisible, but very large.
Someone's in that car.
Instead of coming back, Johnny turned and bent to look inside. When he did, the door swung shut on his head. There was a terrible thudding noise. The stone on Carla's chest was suddenly gone. She drew in breath and screamed out her husband's name.
What's wrong with Daddy?
Rachel cried. Her voice was high and as thin as a reed.
What's wrong with Daddy? Daddy?
Blake yelled. He had been inventorying his newest Transformers and now looked around wildly to see where the daddy in question might be. Carla didn't think. Her husband's body was there, but his head was in the dirty station wagon. He was still alive, though. His arms and legs were flailing. She was out of the expedition with no memory of opening the door. Her own body seemed to be acting on its own, her stunned brain just along for the ride.
Mommy, no!
Rachel screamed.
Mommy, no!
Blake had no idea of what was going on, but he knew it was bad. He began to cry and struggle in his car seat's webwork of straps. Carla grabbed Johnny around the waist and pulled with a crazy super strength of adrenaline. The door of the station wagon came partway open and blood ran over the footing in a little waterfall. For one awful moment, she saw her husband's head lying on the station wagon's muddy seat and cocked crazily to one side. Even though he was still trembling in her arms, she understood, in one of those lightning flashes of clarity that can come even during a perfect storm of panic, that it was how hanging victims looked when they were cut down, because their necks were broken. In that brief, searing moment, that shutter flash glimpse, she thought he looked stupid and surprised and ugly, all the essential Johnny out of him, and knew he was already dead, trembling or not. It was how a kid looked after hitting the rocks instead of the water when he dived. How a woman who had been impaled by her steering wheel looked after her car slammed into a bridge abutment. It was how you looked when disfiguring death came at you out of nowhere. The car door slammed viciously shut. Carla still had her arms wrapped around her husband's waist, and when she was yanked forward, she had another lightning flash of clarity. It's the car. You have to stay away from the car. She let go of Johnny's midsection just a moment too late. A sheaf of her hair fell against the door and was sucked in. The top of her head smacked against the car before she could tear free. Suddenly, the top of her head was burning as the thing ate into her scalp. Run,
she tried to scream to her often troublesome but undeniably bright daughter. Run and take Blakey with you. But before she could even begin to articulate the thought, her mouth was gone. Only Rachel saw the station wagon slam shut on her daddy's head like a Venus flytrap on a bug. But both of them saw their mother somehow pulled through the muddy door as if it were a curtain. They saw one of her mocks come off. They got a flash of her pink toenails. And then she was gone. A moment later, the white car lost its shape and clenched itself like a fist. Through their mother's open window, they heard a crunching sound.
What? That?
Blakey screamed. His eyes were streaming tears and his lower lip was lathered with snot.
What? That? Rachy? What? That? What? That?
They're bones, Rachel thought. She was only 6 years old and not allowed to go to PG-13 movies or watch them on TV, let alone R. Her mother had said R stood for raunchy. But she knew that was the sound of their bones breaking. The car wasn't a car. It was some kind of monster.
Where Mommy and Daddy?
Blakey asked, turning his large eyes now made even larger by his tears on her.
Where Mommy and Daddy, Rachy?
He sounds like he's two again, Rachel thought, and for maybe the first time in her life she felt something other than irritation, or, when extremely tried by his behavior, outright hate, for her baby brother. She didn't think this new feeling was love. She thought it was something even bigger. Her mom hadn't been able to say anything in the end, but if she'd had time, Rachel knew what it would have been. Take care of Blakey. He was thrashing in his car seat. He knew how to undo the straps, but in his panic had forgotten how. Rachel opened her seatbelt, slid out of her booster seat, and tried to do it for him. One of his flailing hands caught her cheek and administered a ringing slap. Under normal circumstances, that would have earned him a hard punch on the shoulder, and a time out in her room where she would have sat staring at the wall in a boiling fugue of fury. But now she just grabbed his hand and held it down.
Stop it. Let me help you. I can get you out, but not if you do that.
He stopped thrashing but kept on crying.
Where Daddy? Where Mommy? I want Mommy.
I want her too, asshole, Rachel thought and undid the car seat straps. We're going to get out now, and we're going to... What? They were going to what? Go up to the restaurant? It was closed. That was why there were orange barrels. That was why the gas pumps in front of the gas station part were gone, and there was grass poking out of the empty parking lot. We're going to get away from here, she finished. She got out of the car and went around to Blakey's side. She opened his door, but he just looked at her, eyes brimming.
I can't get out, Rachy. I'll fall.
Don't be such a scaredy baby, she almost said. Then didn't. This wasn't the time for that. He was upset enough. She opened her arms and she said,
Slide. I'll catch you.
He looked at her doubtfully, then slid. Rachel did catch him, but he was heavier than he looked, and they both went sprawling. She got the worst of it because she was on the bottom, but Blakey bumped his head and scraped one hand and began to bawl loudly, this time in pain instead of fear.
Stop it, she said, and wriggled out from underneath him. Put on your man pants, Blakey.
Huh? She didn't answer. She was looking at the two phones lying beside the terrible station wagon. One of them looked broken, but the other... Rachel edged toward it on her hands and knees, never taking her eye off the car into which their father and mother had disappeared with terrifying suddenness. As she was reaching toward the good phone, Blakey walked past her toward the station wagon, holding out his scraped hand.
Mom, Mommy, come out. I hurted myself. You have to come and kiss it, Bet.
Stop right where you are, Blake Lucier.
Carla would have been proud. It was her she who must be obeyed voice at its most forbidding. And it worked. Blake stopped 4 feet from the side of the station wagon.
But I want Mommy. I want Mommy, Rachy.
She grabbed his hand and pulled him away from the car. Not now. Help me work this thing. She knew perfectly well how to work the phone,
but she had to distract him. Gimme, I can do it. Gimme, Rach. She passed it over, and while he examined the buttons, she got up, took him by the back of his Wolverine t-shirt, and pulled him back 3 steps. Blake hardly noticed. He found the power button of Julie Vernon's cell phone and pushed it. The phone beeped. Rachel took it from him, and for once in his dopey little kid life, Blakey didn't protest. She had listened carefully when McGruff the crime dog had come to talk to them at school, although she knew perfectly well it was only a guy in a McGruff suit, and she did not hesitate now. She punched in 911 and put the phone to her ear. It rang once, then was picked up. Hello, my name is Rachel Ann Lucier, and this call is being recorded, a man's voice overrode her. If you wish to report an emergency, push 1. If you wish to report adverse road conditions, push 2. If you wish to report a stranded motorist,
Rachie, Rachie, where's mommy? Where's dad?
Shh, Rachel said sternly, and pushed 1. It was hard to do. Her hand was trembling and her eyes were all blurry. She realized she was crying. When had she started crying? She couldn't remember. Hello, this is 911, a woman said. Are you real or another recording? Rachel asked. I'm real, the woman said, sounding a little amused. Do you have an emergency?
Yes, a bad car ate up our mother and our daddy. It's at the...
Quit while you're ahead, the 911 woman advised. She sounded more amused than ever. How old are you, kiddo?
I'm 6 and a half, my name is Rachel Ann Lucier, and a bad car.
Listen, Rachel Ann, or whoever you are, I can trace this call. Did you know that? I bet you didn't. Now just hang up, and I won't have to send a policeman to your house to paddle your...
They're dead, you stupid phone person!
Rachel shouted into the phone, and at the D word, Blakey began to cry again. The 911 woman didn't say anything for a moment. Then in a voice no longer amused, Where are you, Rachel Ann?
At the empty restaurant, the one with the orange barrels.
Blakey sat down and put his arms over his face. That hurt Rachel in a way she had never been hurt before. It hurt her deep in her heart. That's not enough information, the 911 lady said. Can you be a little more specific, Rachel Ann? Rachel didn't know what specific meant, but she knew what she was seeing. The back tire of the station wagon, the one closest to them, was melting a little. A tentacle of what looked like liquid rubber was moving slowly across the pavement toward Blakey. I have to go, Rachel said. We have to get away from the bad car. She dragged Blake to his feet, staring at the melting tire. The tentacle of rubber started to go back where it had come from. Because it knows we're out of reach, she thought. And the tire started to look like a tire again. But that wasn't good enough for Rachel. She kept dragging Blake down the ramp and toward the turnpike.
Where are we going, Rachie?
I don't know.
Away from that car. I want my Transformers!
Not now, later. She kept a tight hold on Blake, and kept backing down toward the turnpike, where the occasional traffic was whizzing by at 70 and 80 miles an hour. Nothing is as piercing as a child's scream. It's one of nature's more efficient survival mechanisms. Pete Simmons's sleep had already been thinned to a little more than a doze, and when Rachel screamed at the 911 lady, he heard it, and finally woke up all the way. He sat up, winced, and put a hand to his head. It ached, and he knew what sort of ache it was, the dreaded hangover. His tongue tasted furry, and his stomach was blech. Not, I'm gonna hurl, blech, but blech, just the same. Thank God I didn't drink any more, he thought, and got to his feet. He went to one of the mesh-covered windows to see who was yelling. He didn't like what he saw. Some of the orange barrels blocking the entrance ramp to the rest area had been knocked over, and there were cars down there. Quite a few of them. Then he saw a couple of kids. A little girl in pink pants and a little boy wearing shorts and a t-shirt. He caught just a glimpse of them. Enough to tell that they were backing away, as if something had scared them. And then they disappeared behind what looked to Pete like a horse trailer. Something was wrong. There had been an accident or something, although nothing down there looked like an accident. His first impulse was to get away from here in a hurry, before he got caught up in whatever had happened. He grabbed his saddlebag and started toward the kitchen and the loading dock beyond. Then he stopped. There were kids out there. Little kids. Way too little to be close to a fast road like I-95 on their own, and he hadn't seen any adults. Gotta be grown-ups, didn't you see all those cars? Yes, he'd seen the cars, and a truck hooked up to a horse trailer. But no grown-ups. I have to go out there. Even if I get in trouble, I have to make sure those stupid kids don't get smeared all over the turnpike. Pete hurried to the Burger King's front door, found it locked, and asked himself, what would have been Normie Terrio's question? Hey, after birth, did your mother have any kids that lived? Pete turned and pelted for the loading dock. Running made his headache worse, but he ignored it. He placed the saddlebag at the edge of the concrete platform, lowered himself, and dropped. He landed stupid, banged his tailbone, and ignored that too. He got up and flashed a longing look towards the woods. He could just disappear. Doing so might save him, oh, so much grief down the line. The idea was miserably tempting. This wasn't like the movies, where the good guy always made the right decision without thinking. If somebody smelled vodka on his breath... Jesus, he said. Oh, Jesus, jumped up Rice Krispies, Christ. Why had he ever come here? Holding Blakey firmly by the hand, Rachel walked him all the way to the end of the ramp. Just as they got there, a double-box semi blasted by at 75 miles an hour. The wind blew their hair back, rippled their clothes, and almost knocked Blakey over.
Rachie, I'm scared. We're not supposed to go in the road.
Tell me something I don't know, Rachel thought. At home, they weren't supposed to go any further than the end of the driveway. The traffic on the turnpike was far from constant, but the cars that did come along were going super fast. Besides, where was there to go? They might be able to walk in the breakdown lane, but it would be horribly risky. And there were no exits here, only woods. They could go back to the restaurant, but they would have to walk past the bad car if they did. A red sports car swept past, the guy behind the wheel blaring his horn in a constant wah that made her want to cover her ears. Blake was tugging her, and Rachel let herself be tugged. At one side of the ramp were guardrail posts. Blakey sat down on one of the thick cables running between them, and covered his eyes with his chubby hands. Rachel sat next to him. She didn't know what else to do. 5. Jimmy Golding, 11 Crown Victoria. A child's scream may be one of Mother Nature's more efficient survival mechanisms, but one of mankind's, at least when it comes to automotive traffic on roads with high speed limits, is the parked state police cruiser, especially if the black bulb of the radar detector is facing the oncoming traffic. Drivers doing 70 ease back to 65, drivers doing 80 step on the brake and begin mentally figuring out how many points they'll lose off their licenses if the blue lights go on behind them. It's a salutary effect that wears off quickly 10 or 15 miles further up or down the line and the stampeders are once again stampeding. The beauty of the parked cruiser, at least in Maine State Trooper Jimmy Golding's opinion, was that you didn't really need to do anything. You just pulled over and let nature, human nature in this case, take its guilty course. On this overcast April afternoon, his Simmons speed check radar gun wasn't even on, and the traffic passing southbound on I-95 was just a background drone. All his attention was on the iPad propped against the lower arc of the steering wheel. He was playing a Scrabble-like game called Words with Friends, his internet connection provided by AT&T. His opponent was an old barracks mate named Nick Avery, now with the Oklahoma State Patrol. Jimmy couldn't imagine why anyone would trade Maine for Oklahoma, seemed like a bad decision to him, but there could be no doubt that Nick was an excellent Words with Friends player. He beat Jimmy 9 games out of every 10 and was leading in this one. But Nick's current lead was unusually small, and all the letters were out of the electronic draw bag. If he, Jimmy, could play the four letters he had left, he would win a hard-earned victory. Currently, he was fixated on fix. The four letters he had left were A, E, S, and another F. If he could somehow modify fix, he would not only win, he would kick his old pal's ass. But it didn't look hopeful. He was examining the rest of the board where the prospect seemed even less fruitful when his radio gave two high-pitched tones. It was an all-units alert from 911 in Westbrook. Jimmy tossed his iPad aside and turned up the gain. All units, attention. Who's close to mile 81 rest area, anyone? Jimmy pulled his mic. 911 dispatch, this is 17. I'm currently at mile 85, just south of the Lisbon Sabatis exit. The woman Rachel Lucier thought of as the 911 lady didn't bother to ask if anyone else was closer. In one of the new Crown Vic cruisers, Jimmy was just 3 minutes away, maybe less. 17, I got a call 3 minutes ago from a little girl who says her parents are dead, and since then I've had multiple calls from people who say there are two unaccompanied little kids at the edge of that rest area. He didn't bother to ask why none of those multiple callers had stopped. He had seen it before. Sometimes it was a fear of legal entanglements. More often it was just a case of don't give a shit. There was a lot of that going around. Still, kids. Jesus. 911, I'm on this, 17 out. Jimmy lit his blues, checked his rear view to make sure he had the road, and then peeled out of the gravel pass-through with its sign reading, No U-turn, official vehicles only. The Crown Vic's V8 surged, the digital speedometer blurred up to 92 where it hung. Trees reeled giddily past on both sides of the road. He came up on a lumbering old Buick that stubbornly refused to pull over and swept around it. When he pulled back into the travel lane, Jimmy saw the rest area. And something else. Two little kids. A boy in shorts, a girl in pink pants. Sitting on the guardrail cables beside the entrance ramp. They looked like the world's smallest vagrants, and Jimmy's heart went out to them. He had kids of his own. They stood up when they saw the flashing lights, and for one terrible second, Jimmy thought the little boy was going to step in front of his cruiser. God bless the little girl who grabbed him by the arm and reeled him in. Jimmy decelerated hard enough to activate the ABS system. His citation book, log book, and iPad went cascading off the seat onto the floor. The Vic's front end drifted a little, but he brought it back and parked, blocking the ramp, where several other cars were already parked. What was going on here? The sun came out then, and a word completely unrelated to the current situation flashed through Trooper Jimmy Golding's mind. Affixes. I can make affixes and go out clean. The little girl was running toward the driver's side of the cruiser, dragging her weeping, stumbling kid brother with her. Her face, white and terrified, looked years older than it should have, and there was a big wet patch on the little boy's shorts. Jimmy got out, being careful not to hit them with his door. He dropped on one knee to get to their level, and they rushed into his arms, almost knocking him over.
Whoa, whoa, take it easy, you're all right.
The bad car ate Mommy and Daddy, the little boy said and pointed. The bad car, right there. It ate them all up like the big bad wolf ate Riddle Red Riding Hoop. You have to get them back.
It was impossible to tell which vehicle the chubby finger was pointing at. Jimmy saw four. A station wagon that looked like it had been rode hard along 9 miles of woods road, a spandy clean Prius, a Dodge Ram hauling a horse trailer, and a Ford Expedition. Little girl, what's your name?
I'm Trooper Jimmy.
Rachel Lucier, she said. This is Blakey. He's my little brother. We live at 19 Fresh Winds Way, Falmouth, Maine, 04105. Don't go near it, Trooper Jimmy. It looks like a car, but it's not. It eats people.
Which car are we talking about, Rachel?
The one in front, next to my daddy's, the muddy one.
The muddy car ate Daddy and Mommy, the little boy, Blakey, proclaimed. You get them back. You're a policeman. You got a gun.
Still on one knee, Jimmy held the children in his arms and eyeballed the muddy station wagon. The sun went back in. Their shadows disappeared. On the turnpike, traffic swished past, but slower now,
mindful of those flashing blue lights. No one in the expedition, the Prius, or the truck. He was guessing there was no one in the horse trailer either, unless they were hunkered down, and in that case, the horse would probably seem a lot more nervous than it did. The only vehicle he couldn't see into was the one those kids claimed had eaten their parents. Jimmy didn't like the way the mud was smeared on all its windows. It looked like deliberate mud, somehow. He didn't like the cracked cell phone lying by the driver's door either. Or the ring beside it. The ring was downright creepy. Like the rest of this isn't. The driver's door suddenly creaked partway open, upping the creepy quotient a bit more. Jimmy tensed and put his hand on the butt of his Glock. But no one came out. The door just hung there, 6 inches ajar. "That's how it tries to get you to come in," the little girl said in a voice that was little more than a whisper. "It's a monster car." Jimmy Golding hadn't believed in monster cars since he saw that movie Christine as a kid, but he believed that sometimes monsters could lurk in cars. And someone was in this one. How else had that door opened? It could be one of the kid's parents, hurt and unable to cry out. It could also be a man lying down on the seat so he wouldn't make a shape visible through the mud-smeared rear window. Maybe a man with a gun.
"Who's in the station wagon?" Jimmy called. "I'm a state trooper, and I need you to announce yourself."
No one announced himself.
"Come out, hands first, and I want to see them empty."
The only thing that came out was the sun, printing the door's shadow on the pavement for a second or two before ducking back into the clouds. Then there was only the hanging door. "Come with me, kids," Jimmy said, and shepherded them to his cruiser. He opened the back door. They looked at the back seat with its litter of paperwork, Jimmy's fleece-lined jacket, which he didn't need today, and the shotgun clipped and locked to the back of the bench seat. Especially that.
"Mommy and Daddy say never get into a stranger's car,"
the boy named Blakey said.
"They say it at school, too. Stranger danger."
"He's a policeman with a policeman's car," Rachel said. "It's okay, get in, and if you touch that gun, I'll smack you."
"Good advice on the gun, but it's secured and the trigger lock's on," Jimmy said. Blakey got in and peered over the seat.
"Hey, you got an iPad!"
"Shut up," Rachel said. She started to get in, then looked at Jimmy Golding with tired, horrified eyes. "Don't touch it. It's sticky." Jimmy almost smiled. He had a daughter only a year or so younger than this little girl, and she might have said the same thing. He guessed little girls divided naturally into two groups, tomboys and dirt haters. Like his Ellen, this one was a dirt hater. It was with this soon-to-be-fatal misconception of what Rachel Lucier meant by sticky that he closed them in the back seat of Unit 17. He leaned in the front window of the cruiser and snared his mic. He never took his eyes from the hanging door of the station wagon, and so did not see the little boy standing next to the rest area restaurant holding an imitation leather saddlebag against his chest like a small blue baby. A moment later, the sun peeked out again, and Pete Simmons was swallowed up by the restaurant shadow. Jimmy called into the gray barracks.
17, come back.
I'm at the old Mile 81 rest area. I have 4 abandoned vehicles, 1 abandoned horse, and 2 abandoned children. One of the vehicles is a station wagon. The kids say...
He paused, then thought, what the hell?
The kids say it ate their parents.
Come back?
I think they mean someone inside grabbed them. I want you to send all available units over here. Copy?
Copy all available units, but it'll be 10 minutes before the first one gets there. That's Unit 12. He's code 73 in Waterville.
Al Andrews. No doubt chowing down at Bob's Burgers and talking politics.
Copy that.
Give me MML on the wagon, 17, and I'll run it.
Negative on all 3, no plate. As far as make and model, the thing is so covered with mud I can't tell. It's American, though.
I think.
Probably a Ford or a Chevy. The kids are in my cruiser. Names are Rachel and Blakey Lucier, Fresh Winds Way, Falmouth. I forget the street number.
19!
Rachel and Blakey shouted together.
They say, I got it, 17, and which car did they come in?
Daddy's Expedition,
Blakey cried, happy to be of help. Ford Expedition, Jimmy said. Plate number 3772IY. I'm going to approach that station wagon.
Copy. Be careful there, Jimmy.
Copy that. Oh, and will you reach out to 911 dispatch and tell her the kids are all right?
Is that you talking or Peter Townsend?
Very funny.
17, I'm 62.
He started to replace the mic, then handed it to Rachel. If anything happens, anything bad, you push that button on the side and yell 30. That means officer needs help. Have you got it? Yes, but you shouldn't go near that car, Trooper Jimmy. It bites, and it eats, and it's sticky. Blakey, who in his wonder at being in an actual police car had temporarily forgotten what had befallen his parents, now remembered and began to cry again.
I want Mommy and Daddy.
In spite of the weirdness and potential danger of the situation, Rachel Lucier's eye-rolling, you see what I have to deal with expression almost made Jimmy laugh. How many times had he seen that exact same expression on the face of 5-year-old Ellen Golding? Listen, Rachel, Jimmy said. I know you're scared, but you're safe in here, and I have to do my job. If your parents are in that car, we don't want them hurt, do we?
Go get Mommy and Daddy, Trooper Jimmy,
Blakey trumpeted.
We don't want them hurt!
Jimmy saw hope spark in the girl's eyes, but not as much as he might have expected. Like Agent Mulder on the old X-Files show, she wanted to believe. But like Mulder's partner, Agent Scully, she didn't. What had these kids seen? Be careful, Trooper Jimmy. She raised one finger. It was a schoolteacherly gesture made even more endearing by a slight tremble. Don't touch it. As Jimmy approached the station wagon, he drew his Glock service automatic but left the safety on, for the time being. Standing slightly south of the hanging door, he once again invited anyone inside to exit the vehicle, open and empty hands foremost. No one came out. He reached for the door, then remembered the little girl's parting admonition, and hesitated. He reached out with the barrel of his gun to swing the door open. Only the door didn't open, and the barrel of the pistol stuck fast. The thing was a glue pot. He was jerked forward as if a powerful hand had gripped the Glock's barrel and yanked. There was a second when he could have let go, but such an idea never even surfaced in his mind. One of the first things they taught you at the academy after weapons issue was that you never let go of your sidearm. Never. So he held on. And the car that had already eaten his gun now ate his hand and his arm. The sun came out again, casting his diminishing shadow on the pavement. Somewhere, children were screaming. The station wagon affixes itself to the trooper, he thought. Now I know what she meant by stick. Then the pain bloomed large, and all thought ceased. There was time for one scream. Only one. 6. The Kids. 10. Richforth. From where he was standing 70 yards away, Pete saw it all. He saw the state trooper reach out with the barrel of his gun to open the station wagon's door the rest of the way. He saw the barrel disappear into the door as if the whole car were nothing but an optical illusion. He saw the trooper jerk forward, his big gray hat tumbling from his head. Then the trooper was yanked through the door, and only his hat was left, lying next to somebody's cell phone. There was a pause, and then the car pulled into itself, like fingers into a fist. Next came the tennis racket on ball sound. Puck. And the muddy clenched fist became a car again. The little boy began to wail. The little girl was, for some reason, screaming 30 over and over again,
like she thought it was a magic word J.K. Rowling had somehow left out of her Harry Potter books. The back door of the police car opened. The kids got out. Both of them were crying their asses off, and Pete didn't blame them. If he hadn't been so stunned by what he'd just seen, he'd probably be crying himself. A nutty thought came to him. Another swig or two of that vodka might improve this situation. It would help him be less afraid, and if he was less afraid, he might be able to figure out what the fuck he should do. Meanwhile, the kids were backing away again. Pete had an idea they might panic and take to their heels in any second. He couldn't let them do that. They'd run right into the road and get splatted by turnpike traffic.
"Hey!" he shouted. "Hey, you kids!"
When they turned to look at him, big, buggy eyes and pale faces, he waved and started walking toward them. As he did, the sun came out again, this time with authority. The little boy started forward. The girl jerked him back. At first, Pete thought she was afraid of him, then realized it was the car she was afraid of. He made a circling gesture with his hand.
"Walk around it! Walk around and come over here!"
They slipped through the guardrails on the left side of the ramp, giving the station wagon the widest berth possible, then cut across the parking lot. When they got to Pete, the little girl let go of her brother, sat down, and put her face in her hands. She had braids her mom had probably fixed for her. Looking at them, and knowing the kid's mother would never fix them for her again, made Pete feel horrible. The little boy looked up solemnly.
"It ate Mommy and Daddy. It ate the horse lady, and Trooper Jimmy, too. It's gonna eat everyone, I guess. It's gonna eat the world."
If Pete Simmons had been 20, he might have asked a lot of bullshit questions that didn't matter. Because he was only half that age and able to accept what he had just seen, he asked something simpler and more pertinent.
"Hey, little girl, are more police coming? Is that why you were yelling 30?
She dropped her hands and looked up at him. Her eyes were raw and red.
"Yes, but Blakey's right. It will eat them too. I told Trooper Jimmy, but he didn't believe me."
Pete believed her, because he had seen. But she was right. The police wouldn't believe. But they would, eventually. They'd have to. But maybe not before the monster car ate a bunch more of them.
"I think it's from space," he said. "Like on Doctor Who?"
"Mommy and Daddy won't let us watch that," the little boy told him. "They say it's too scary." "But this is scarier."
"It's alive."
Pete spoke more to himself than to them.
"Duh,"
Rachel said and gave a long, miserable sniffle. The sun ducked briefly behind one of the unraveling clouds. When it came out again, an idea came with it. Pete had been hoping to show Normie Terrio and the rest of the rip-ass raiders something that would amaze them enough to let him be part of their gang. Then George had given him a big brotherly reality check. They've all seen that baby trick 1,000 times. Maybe so. But maybe that thing down there hadn't seen it 1,000 times. Or even once. Maybe they didn't have magnifying glasses where it came from. Or sun, for that matter. He remembered a Doctor Who episode about a planet where it was dark all the time. He could hear a siren in the distance. A cop was coming. A cop who wouldn't believe anything little kids said, because as far as grown-ups were concerned, little kids were all full of shit.
"You guys stay here. I'm gonna try something."
"No."
The little girl grasped his wrist with fingers that felt like claws.
"It'll eat you too."
"I don't think it can move around," Pete told her, disengaging his hand. She had left a couple of bleeding scratches, but he wasn't mad, and he didn't blame her. He probably would have done the same if it had been his parents.
"I think it's stuck in one place."
"It can reach," she said. "It can reach with its tires. They melt."
"I'll watch out," Pete said. "But I have to try this, because you're right. Those cops will come, and it will eat them too."
"Stay put."
He walked toward the station wagon. When he was close, but not too close, he unzipped the saddlebag. "I have to try this," he had told the kids. But the truth was a little balder. He wanted to try this. It would be like a science experiment. That would probably sound bizarre if he told someone, but he didn't have to tell. He just had to do it. Very, very carefully. He was sweating. With the sun out, the day had turned warm, but that wasn't the only reason, and he knew it. He looked up, squinting at the brightness. "Don't you go back behind a cloud. Don't you dare. I need you." He took his rich fourth magnifying glass out of the saddlebag and bent to put the saddlebag on the pavement. The joints of his knees cracked, and the station wagon's door swung open a few inches. "It knows I'm here. I don't know if it can see me, but it heard me just now. And maybe it smells me." He took another step. Now he was close enough to touch the side of the station wagon. If he was fool enough to do so, that was. "Watch out!" the little girl called. She and her brother were both standing now, their arms around each other. "Watch out for it!" Carefully, like a kid reaching into a cage with a lion inside, Pete extended the magnifying glass. A circle of light appeared on the side of the station wagon, but it was too big. Too soft. He moved the glass closer. "The tire!" the little boy screamed. "Watch out for the tire!" Pete looked down and saw one of the tires melting. A tentacle was oozing across the pavement towards his sneaker. He couldn't back away without giving up his experiment. So he raised his foot and stood stork. The tentacle immediately changed direction and headed for his other foot. Not much time. He moved the magnifying glass closer. The circle of light shrank to a brilliant white dot. For a moment, nothing happened. Then tendrils of smoke began to drift up. The muddy white surface beneath the dot turned black. From inside the station wagon, there came an inhuman growling sound. Pete had to fight every instinct in his brain and body to keep from running. His lips parted, revealing teeth locked together in a desperate snarl. He held the rich fourth steady, counting off seconds in his head. He'd reached 7 when the growl rose to a glassy shriek that threatened to split his head. Behind him, Rachel and Blake had let go of each other so they could cover their ears. At the foot of the rest area entrance ramp, Al Andrews brought Unit 12 to a sliding stop. He got out, wincing at that terrible shrieking sound. It was like an air raid siren broadcast through a heavy metal band's amplifiers, he would say later. He saw a kid holding something out so it almost touched the surface of a muddy old Ford or Chevy station wagon. The boy was wincing in pain, determination, or both. The smoking black spot on the flank of the station wagon began to spread. The white smoke curling up from it began to thicken. It turned gray, then black. What happened next happened fast. Pete saw tiny blue flames pop into being around the black spot. They spread, seeming to dance above the surface of the car thing. It was the way charcoal briquettes looked in their backyard barbecue after their father doused them with lighter fluid and tossed in a match. The gooey tentacle which had almost reached the sneakered foot still standing on the pavement snapped back. The car yanked in upon itself again, but this time, the spreading blue flames stood out all around it in a corona. It pulled in tighter and still tighter, becoming a fiery ball. Then as Pete and the Lucier kids and Trooper Andrews watched, it shot up into the blue spring sky. For a moment longer it was there, glowing like a cinder. And then it was gone. Pete found himself thinking of the cold darkness above the envelope of the Earth's atmosphere, those endless leagues where anything might live and lurk. "I didn't kill it. I just drove it away. It had to go so it could put itself out like a burning stick in a bucket of water. Trooper Andrews was staring up into the sky, dumbfounded. One of his brain's few working circuits was wondering how he was supposed to write up a report on what he had just seen. There were more approaching sirens in the distance. Pete walked back to the two little kids with his saddlebag in one hand and his Richforth magnifying glass in the other. He sort of wished George and Normie were here. But so what if they weren't? He'd had quite an afternoon for himself without those guys, and he didn't care if he got grounded or not. This made jumping bikes off the edge of a stupid sandpit look tame. You know what? I fucking rock. He might have laughed if the little kids hadn't been looking at him. They had just seen their parents eaten by some kind of alien, eaten alive. And showing happiness would be totally wrong. The little boy held out his chubby arms and Pete picked him up. He didn't laugh when the kid kissed his cheek, but he smiled.
Thanks,
Blakey said.
You're a good kid.
Pete set him down. The little girl also kissed him, which was sort of nice, although it would have been nicer if she'd been a babe. The trooper was running toward them now, and that made Pete think of something. He bent to the little girl and huffed into her face. Do you smell anything? Rachel Lucier looked at him wisely for a moment.
You'll be okay,
she said and actually smiled. It was only a small one, but better than no smile at all. Just don't breathe on him. And maybe get some mints or something before you go home.
I was thinking tea berry gum,
Pete said.
Yeah,
Rachel said.
That'll work.
For Nye Wilden and Doug Allen, who bought my first stories. My mother had a saying for every occasion, and Steve remembers them all, I can hear my wife, Tabitha, say with an accompanying roll of her eyes. One of Mom's favorites was, milk always takes the flavor of what it sits next to in the icebox. I don't know if that's true about milk, but it's certainly true when it comes to the stylistic development of young writers. When I was a young man, I wrote like H.P. Lovecraft, when I was reading Lovecraft. And like Ross MacDonald, when I was reading The Adventures of P.I. Lou Archer. Stylistic copying eventually wanes. Little by little, writers develop their own styles, each as unique as a fingerprint. Traces of the writers one reads in one's formative years remain, but the rhythm of each writer's thoughts, an expression of his or her very brainwaves, I think, eventually becomes dominant. In the end, no one sounds like Elmore Leonard but Leonard, and no one sounds like Mark Twain, but Twain. Yet, every now and then, stylistic copying recurs, always when the writer encounters some new and wonderful mode of expression that shows him a new way of seeing and saying. Salem's Lot was written under the influence of James Dickey's poetry, and if Rose Madder sounds in places as if it were written by Cormac McCarthy, it's because, while I was writing that book, I was reading everything by McCarthy I could get my hands on. In 2009, an editor at the New York Times Book Review asked if I would do a double review of Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, by Carol Sklenica, and Carver's own collected stories as published by Library of America. I agreed, mostly so I could explore some new territory. Although I am an omnivorous reader, I had somehow missed Carver, a large blind spot for a writer who came of literary age at roughly the same time Carver did, you might say, and you would be right. All I can say in my own defense is, quot libros, quam breve tempus. So many books, so little time. And yes, I have the T-shirt. In any case, I was stunned by the clarity of Carver's style and by the beautiful tension of his prose line. Everything is on the surface, but that surface is so clear that the reader can see a living universe just beneath. I loved those stories, and I loved the American losers Carver wrote about with such knowledge and tenderness. Yes, the man was a drunk, but he had a